All right. Good evening, everybody. This is Eric Dryman, host of the Hooks and Hoses podcast, brought to you by Fire Engineering. I want to welcome everybody tonight to the podcast and introduce a very special guest tonight, Chief Mo Davis from the Houston Fire Department. Big Mo is a friend of mine and somebody that I met a few years ago and have had the opportunity to spend a little time with and teach with. And you're never going to find a more passionate, engaged fireman, I don't think, than Chief Mo Davis. So, Mo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a big pleasure to get to do this.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. I know for those of you that you won't hear the first recording, but Chief was on duty yesterday, and we tried to do this, and I don't know, you know, the fire gods down in Houston were blessing Chief Davis last night, and he was getting a lot of work, so we didn't get it done the first time. Hopefully, we'll get it done this time. No fires today, hopefully.
Oh, yes, sir. I'm off all day.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Well, Chief, tell us a little bit about yourself and where you came from, how you got your start, what motivated you to become a fireman with the Houston Fire Department.
Yes. Well, you know, I grew up in a rural area, and my grandfather was a volunteer fireman, and I was just drawn to it as a young kid. I think as we talked before, I was about 5 years old, and I can remember the camaraderie that those guys had. They were dragging a lake for a body. And I was there with my mom. We had taken some food to them. And from that point on, you know, I think I was drawn to everything from the uniform to the, you know, just the guys hanging out. And as a little boy, my mom said that that's all I ever talked about was being a fireman. Well, as I was getting older, you know, I didn't want to stay around the small town. I wanted to actually go where, you know, you get to do some work. And I was, you know, one of the luckiest guys in the world, I think. I got hired by the Houston Fire Department. When I got in, there was about 9,000 of us took the exam for like a little over 160 jobs, I think it was. And, man, God was good to me. And he let me in. And I got to go to a very busy station and stayed there most of my career. And then from there, I went to 68s. You know, I just wanted to be a big city fireman. And, you know, I'm right at about almost 28 years now, I think. And I've never even thought one day about retiring. I love every single day I go to work.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun when you consider your job not going to work, right?
That's exactly it. I don't think I've ever worked a day in my life in the fire department. I love it.
Yeah, I hear you. I've never had a real job myself, so. Been a firefighter ever since I graduated from college, and it's the only job I've ever had. So that's a good thing. And for those of you out there that are firefighters, you know, you understand what we're talking about. Chief, just tell us a little bit about, you know, when you were coming up in the fire department. I know I had people that influenced me and made a difference in my career, whether I realized it at the time or not. But who were some of the people that helped you out, guided you, directed you to continue to stick with this and ultimately achieve the rank of district chief in the Houston Fire Department?
I tell you, I was very lucky. When I come off the tower, the training tower, and went to the station, I was with Delbert Burleson. And Delbert Burleson was a downtown fireman, all business kind of guy, you know, from the uniform to the fire ground. And man, he just took a liking to me, and he put a big interest in me. And so he kind of showed me the way as a young man. And then I also worked for Captain Dale Jenkins. And if anybody knows Captain Jenkins was known as the general. And he believed in training. And, you know, we were making, you know, 20, 25 runs on a pumper back then. And Captain Jenkins always found time to make us better. A lot of people looked at it as, you know, he was just harassing us and working us hard. But it was just the total opposite. He cared that much about us that he trained us for the, you know, the unknowns. I mean, I tell people this story all the time about Captain Jenkins. We'll be returning from a run at night. Captain Jenkins would see a burned out house and we would stop. We would ladder it and walk the roof just where he could show us what a weak roof felt like. So he was a big mentor of mine. And then, of course, Chief Hooker. If anybody knows me, knows that I love Chief Hooker probably as good as anybody. He was so good to me. He encouraged me to develop, and he took a lot of pride in us. And you know, we were the Hooker boys, you know. And he pushed us to be the best in the city, and he put his name on us, and he expected that. So he was a big mentor of mine. And even to today, I run my fires. I hope I can say this. I run my fires like he did. I saw him being really engaged. I saw him really, you know, studying and understanding the profession. And I try to emulate everything he did still to this day. So then, me and you've talked about this before, you know, you got Ronnie Martin, Chief Miller, these guys, you know, I call them anytime I can call them, and they will help me. But another big one, and I've done a podcast with him, and it was probably one of my biggest honors, was Mike Phillips, who's a legendary chief in the Houston Fire Department. And I remember when I took the captain's exam. It's kind of a funny story, so, but I'll tell you, it means a lot to me. I don't even know if it means that much to him, but it sure did me. So in the Houston Fire Department, when you take a promotional exam, all the chiefs gather, and I think they mainly gather for bragging rights. You know, my guy beat your guy, and, you know, it's just real competitive. So I come out of the exam, and, of course, Chief Hooker's there, and he goes, "Mo, how'd you do?" And I said, "Well, I did real good." And, you know, in front of all of his chief buddies, he goes, "What does real good mean?" I said, "Well, I'm going to get made the first go around." Well, I never will forget, and I actually got a cold chill just telling you this. Chief Phillips told Chief Hooker, said, "Hey, Fred, I got him." He said, "You just stay here, because my buddy Tim Dunn was taking the exam too, and Chief wanted to see how he did." So Chief Phillips was walking me, and we have to walk probably a half a mile. We take the test downtown at the George R. Brown. And on the way down, he was mentoring me and advising me that they had invested a lot in me over the years, and he didn't expect me to let him down. And he was telling me that the decisions I make the rest of my career will always come back on the training I had from Chief Hooker, guys like him, and he didn't expect me to do anything but carry on what they gave me. And I still try to do this today. You know, I probably talk to Chief Phillips probably once a week. I talked to Chief Hooker, not so much. He's retired now. I call and check on him. But I call these guys with problems all the time, or if I have something that goes bad, or, you know, there's nothing like talking to a brother fireman. So if I got a bad day, you know, had a bad fire that didn't go my way, I can call him, and he will usually have the answer by just drawing a mental picture. So, you know, man, I'm just so lucky to have those guys. Still have them in my life today that I can call on them. So I've had a lot of great mentors.
No, that's great. It is amazing. You know, you can, the one thing about this job is, you don't have to go very far on this job to find somebody that's going to listen to you, support you. You know, just as you often say, it's truly a brotherhood, a family. You know, it's not just a job where you're going to a factory and punching a clock, or walking in an office building and sitting in a cubicle or something like that. It's just so much different. And, you know, those of us on this podcast, everybody on this podcast knows what I'm talking about, but it's just, I'm always amazed to hear, you know, it doesn't matter where you're at, whether you're in Indianapolis, Indiana, or Houston, Texas, or Paris, France, wherever, you walk in a firehouse and you tell them you're a fireman, and you got somebody to help you out. So it's great.
I agree with that 100%. That, you know, I say this a lot, and I think most real firemen, and I think you'll get this too, knowing you and our friendship. I don't care what patch you wear. I don't care how big your department is. I don't care how small your department is, whether you're paid or volunteer. We're all the same. We're all brothers. We're all sisters. And I think the real firemen out there, and the real firemen on time, they will go out of your way to help you at no cost. And you know, this is kind of a sad note, but I'll pass this on to anyone listening. God forbid you get cancer, you come to the city of Houston, there's a Houston fireman that will help you with MD Anderson. We will make sure that you're picked up at the airport. We will make sure you're taken care of and your family's taken care of, and somebody will come by and see you at MD Anderson. And as sad as the subject is, cancer is, I think that's a plus side on the brotherhood. You know, I've seen guys from Los Angeles. We took one actually to my side job. He had brain cancer. And you know, you get to forget about cancer for 30 minutes and sit down and eat food with some brother firemen and just laugh about being a fireman. So, you know, the brotherhood exists. They'll never take that from us, I don't think.
No, that's you know, it's one of those things that we're pretty fortunate in this job to have. So I was I've told a few people, you know, in preparation for this podcast, I have guys I work with that'll ask me who's going to be on this month and that sort of thing. And I told them I was interviewing Chief Davis from Houston, and I had a couple guys say, you got to ask him about the gear. You got to ask him about the fire gear. You know, we hear those guys can walk through walls of fire, and how do they handle the heat, and how do they deal with the humidity and the thickness of the gear and everything. So tell us a little bit of history about why the Houston Fire Department started using that gear. I'm familiar with the Reed hood, but
yes, sir.
You know, how did you guys get to the point where you were wearing fire gear that was so thick and durable? And do you still wear that same level of fire gear, or have you kind of backed off of that a little bit?
Yes, sir. Man, that's actually a good question. And Captain Clifford Reed, very good friend of mine. We still travel together and teach together. And you know, he's getting older now, so he doesn't drive, but he'll ride with us. And we get to, you know, hear it. And I was lucky as a young firefighter. I actually got to ride with him on a pumper. And, man, you talk about an honor, because Captain Reed literally burnt his body up making sure firemen would be okay. And so Captain Reed had this ideal that if we kept our shoulders and head cool, that we could maintain our mental capacity to do what we're supposed to. And the Houston Fire Department has always been aggressive. I mean, you go back to the Captain Bars, the Captain Bowens, the Captain Houks. I could name people forever that these guys really set a high standard on aggressiveness. And Captain Reed thought, well, man, we're getting burnt. And you'll know this. And the young guys may not know this, but the old guys remember it. When I first got in the Houston Fire Department, every refrigerator had a jar of Sylvadine in it, because we were always getting burnt. Yeah. So Captain Reed had this thought that if he could cover us up better, he would do it. And so if I can, you know, aggress just for a second, we would go to the academy and we would cut liners out of old destroyed gear, and we would wear a sweatshirt, a liner, and then put our coat over top of it. And then we put a couple hoods. Well, the Houston Fire Department, with Captain Reed's help, went and had special coats made. And so our coats are on our shoulders from like our nipple line up, is probably about 2.5-3 inches thick of protective layer. And so then we wasn't getting our shoulders and backs burned. So then Captain Reed came up with the Reed hood. And the first one he sewed was, and construction guys will know this, those old black liners that you used to put under your hard hat to keep your ears warm in the winter.
Yeah.
His mom actually cut one and fitted it. Well, then he got his throat burnt, and he went back to his mom, Captain Reed did, and his mom came up with the idea that she could sew one on and put a piece of Velcro on it. So that evolved, and that evolved to the point where Captain Reed got the gear manufacturers to actually take our coat and replicate the interior, the moisture barrier, and the outer layer to develop a hood. So then we wore Reed hoods. So, We went to a very thick special sock hood now, because the Reed hoods were so hard to get.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as our gear and the gauntlet gloves, Captain Reed prototyped, we still use that. And yeah, you know, some people give us flack for it, and we kind of understand that. A lot of us don't know any different. You know, it's just the way we were taught.
Yeah.
But if you look at the and I guess if I can brag just a little bit, but if you look at the amount of saves we have every year, I really contributed to the tactics that those old guys developed years ago. And then the gear that Captain Reed them developed, that we're fortunate to do that. And it's all because of gear, but is it hot? Oh man, it's hot. So as soon as we get the fire knocked down, you know, we usually come out and breathe a little bit without it. But as far as protecting firefighters and as far as making it good for citizens, man, I love it. And I don't know if I'd be brave enough to fight fire if we didn't have that good gear.
It's a big change from a Nomex coat with a wool liner and day boots. I know that's how I started. Yeah. So.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I would like to say, you know, I'm a squirrel. Anybody knows me knows I'm a fire squirrel. But, boy, I would have liked to wear some hip boots just to say I did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you talked about being aggressive. And, you know, I know Houston, know several people from Houston, and I know never had the opportunity to ride out there or visit there, but been around enough Houston firefighters to know that they're pretty proud of getting in and getting after it, you know, to fire. So I know you have a phrase or term that you like to use called aggressive command. And, you know, you're a district chief, which for those of us that want the translation, that's a battalion chief and district chief are the same thing. Chief Davis has, what you say, four stations, I think you told me that
yes sir.
Yeah,
yes, so. Sir. And we're kind of odd because I have four that I'm primarily responsible for, but then we always respond to four more chiefs surrounding us, so it spreads out. But my big responsibility is four. Yes, sir.
Sure. Yeah, that's still a lot, you know. Four firehouses, you know, especially busy firehouses like you have there in your district. I know that's still a big responsibility. So, talk to us a little bit about. When you talk about aggressive command and being not only being the incident commander, but still not being a windshield chief, as I call them, people that sit in there in their battalion buggy and watch the incident evolve out the windshield, you're on the fire ground, you're getting after it, and you're still running the incident. So how do you manage to balance that? Because I think it would be pretty easy. You know, you said you're kind of a fire squirrel. But to me, you know, running an incident and, it just takes a lot of mental effort to be able to do all that and still stay in charge and stay on top of what's going on. So talk to us a little bit about that and where you came up with that idea of aggressive command and how you make it happen.
Yeah. You know, I stole it from Chief Hooker. You know, I just put a name on it, you know, but I just stole exactly what I seen him. And, you know, we had an old chief named Chris Chavez, too, was another mentor of mine I forgot to mention earlier. And I would watch him. So him and Chief Hooker was always up close to the fire. And Chief Hooker always preached as we were coming up. And Chief Tim Dunn and I grew up under Chief Hooker. And he always kind of mentored us that as an incident commander, all of your other guys are working. Everybody has a specific job. And for the non-firemen out there, it probably looks like chaos. But then you take us, firemen across the country, it's really organized chaos. Everyone has an assignment. So Chief Hooker felt like if he watched, and if anybody's taking notes, this would probably be the three things to write down. A young incident commander should watch the color of the smoke. An incident commander should watch the movement of the hose line. And the next thing he's got to do is watch that roof line to make sure it doesn't sag on the guys. So if you're in your car, I feel you can't watch those three things. And guys up there is working. You know, they're pulling slack. They're pulling ceiling. You know, you got guys going in and going out. They can't watch that. Well, as an incident commander, I think if you get up there and you get actively involved in what your guys are doing, you actually become like a safety officer. And as funny and as silly as this sounds, if you're sending a guy that you care about to their potential death, it puts a personal touch on it. If you're there with them and you touch them, or a captain comes up, you know, it stops a lot of the radio traffic. You're like, hey, captain, I need you to pull a backup line and go here. Or, hey, captain, I need you to cut a hole here. It puts a personal touch on it. And then the guys know that you're watching exactly what they're doing. And so here is what I think, you know, and I don't think that I'm that smart, but I think that if you train with the guys and I get out and train, and I know every member of my district, and I try to know their pros and their cons, and I try to know where their positives and negatives are. And then I even want to have it such a personal point that I know if they're having a bad day. So then once you do that, and you know, you've got a captain that's good at cutting holes, or you got a captain that's good at primary search. If I'm up there on the fire ground watching what's going on, I don't have to micromanage them whatsoever. And we're lucky in Houston Fire Department. We have ICTs, or incident command technicians. And so I've got a very good one, and that he spent his whole career on the Southwest side. So I rely on him, and then I get to be aggressive by being involved and knowing what's happening. If I'm standing at the front door, and I just use the hose line, for example. If I'm standing at the front door and I see them pull 200 foot inside, I know, well, they probably missed the fire. Or if I'm standing at the front and I see fire blowing out a window, I see that smoke start changing from black to white, I know that they're getting it. But then on the backside of that is if I see them in there working and that smoke starts getting turbulent, the smoke starts getting fast, the smoke starts turning black and hot, I know that we have to come up with a different plan. And it just me personally, I don't think I can feel that by sitting in a car. And I'll be honest, you know, I guess I'm sheltered in the fire service, but I don't even know where that came from. And, you know, and I have friends of mine tell me, well, I can think better if I'm sitting in the car, I don't have anybody around me. But my approach is, if I can see it, and you know what I'm talking about. You've been a fireman a long time, and if there's non-firemen on here, they won't get this. You can feel, and I guess it's the fireman's sixth sense, I think. You can feel when things are going your way. And I just think that it's up there. And, yeah, you know, sometimes it's hot. I do put my gear on still. It's hot up there. Sometimes I get rained on, but the guys are too. And in a squirrely way, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think the guys respect me because I'm not better than them, you know? And then if I'm a division officer, I even get a little bit more involved. I think if they sign me to a Charlie division, instead of me just standing out there being better than everybody else, and I need to stick my head in there every once in a while and just make sure everything's okay. And I just need to ask them, not that I'm micromanaging them in any way, but they're working. And I'm more like a safety officer. And so that's where the aggressiveness came from. And I just put the aggressive in there because I would like to see someday. And, man, I have a long time left, brother. I've never one day thought about retiring. So in my next 15 years or so in the fire service, I hope I see where incident commanders actually become one with their guys, because it's such a blessing to, and I tell this, and I truly believe this, and I get to sit back and watch greatness every day with the guys I have in my district. I mean, these guys work miracles. And sometimes, you know, I'll give up on them and then they'll start looking better. And so I think if chiefs start doing that, and it's a learning curve, and if anybody wants to call me, man, I am an open book. You know, I live in the country. You know this for being my friend.
Yeah.
I don't have good phone. But when I come back to town, I will call and talk to you. And so that's what aggressive is. It's just being part of the team. And it's get out of your office. You know, if you're a chief that sits in your room all day, man, you're doing those guys such a disservice, and you're missing out on a lot. And you get out there, and those young guys will teach you. Man, I got a lot of young guys in my district, and those young guys, man, they make me better every day. So, yeah, that's what it is. It's just getting out, being involved. And heck, man, and we're lucky in Houston Fire Department. On a Friday or Saturday night, Captain Mario or Captain Schroeder, they're just getting it handed to them. Man, we can ride up one. Man, I'll jump on the truck or the pumper and let them ride up and give them a little bit of a break. And so all of that, in my opinion, is aggressiveness. And all that does is let the guys know, man, he doesn't think he's better than me. And then it keeps your skills up too. So that's the point. It's just being involved and knowing your guys. And I think, man, I don't mean to ramble, but I think if you know your guys, you're friends with your guys, you care about them more. And so that's, and in my opinion, that's what makes a good leader. And I hope I can say I'm a quarter of the leader that my chief was, because that's what he did us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important for those of you on here that are listening to this who want to be officers, or maybe you are an officer, whether you're a lieutenant, captain, chief, whatever it is, that goes a long way. What Chief Davis just said, you know, never forgetting where you came from. You can't think that just because, oh, now I'm the lieutenant or I'm the chief, I don't have to do housework. I don't have to mop the floors. I don't have to help cook a meal. I don't have to help reload the hose on the pumper. I mean, that stuff goes so far with people, particularly if you're a chief officer. You know, never think that you're too good to get your hands dirty. Just because you got that white hat on and that white shirt doesn't mean that you still can't get after it and do the right thing by your guys and gals and help them out and get the job done. That means a lot to people.
Yeah, that's you know, I want to be as dirty as them. You know, those guys are dirty, man. I want to be dirty and snotty like them. Hey, can I tell you a story real quick and brag on a guy?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I was a young fireman, and I had never worked over here. It was a richer part of town, and so, you know, I didn't really work in those parts of town much. But a guy needed off, and he's a friend of mine. I said, "Man, I'll go help you." So I walk in the station, and there's this old man. And when I say an old man, he is old. And the pumper and ambulance is going. He's out there mopping the floor, and so I jump in and I help him. And me and him's talking and having a conversation. And we're just, you know, just down to earth and having a ball. And so we cleaned up the whole station. Well, later on, we're in the kitchen for breakfast, and the man walks in with his uniform, and he's the captain. So it's Captain Higgins.
Yeah.
And I would have never in a million years thought he was the captain the way he was working. Well, as years passed, I become friends with his two sons, Paul and Ricky. And they said that their dad taught them that way. And I can still remember, you know, 22, 23 years ago, this old man was cleaning the station by himself without his uniform on, and then he showed back up. He was a captain. You know, that's a class act, in my opinion.
Yeah, that is. That says a lot about somebody.
Yeah.
So when you're on the fire ground, how do you balance? You know, I know you and Houston are aggressive, and you make a lot of saves every year, and you do a lot of good for the public. How do you, as an incident commander, as a district chief, balance the putting the public first and still taking care of the people that you're, you know, the firefighters on the fire ground and watching out for them?
Watching out for the firefighters, I think, begins with training. If we train hard and we do realistic training and we do legitimate training, we do grid training, we do that. And we keep, in my district, we keep everything to the basics. I think that's how we make firemen safe. Now, in my opinion, civilians always comes first. There for a while, you know, some people were saying, well, we're first, then them. And I never bought into that concept. And I always believed that civilians come first. And some people's not going to like this, but I don't mean it mean when I say it. But I never bought into the concept of risk a lot, save a lot, risk nothing, save nothing. Because I think that sends us out the door of a bad mindset. Every response I've ever made, in the back of my head, I planned on someone being trapped. Still to this day, every time we make a run, I have the mindset of someone's trapped. And when I was a captain, I did assignments like that. My actions were always based on putting the line between the fire and potential victims, doing good searches. And we did things right. Like, you know, it's a little controversial, but if we had a bedroom burning, well, we wouldn't just start squirting water from the living room. We would get back there to where it's burning, and we may hold off just for a second to make sure somebody wasn't in that room before, where we wouldn't steam them.
Mm-hmm.
So now as a chief, I just carry it to the next step. My assignments are always given in hopes of, or potentially hopes of, pulling someone out. And for example, if I pull up and I've got smoke rolling out at ankle deep, well, one of my first thoughts as a truck is to cut a hole. And then I'm hoping to lift all that stuff up off the victims, and I'm hoping to make it safer for the firemen going in. But in order, I think, to do that, is, man, we just got to always think we have to have a mindset that there's always someone trapped. And if we go to every single fire thinking somebody's trapped, we go back to the basics, and that's line placement, search, and ventilation. And I think if we don't get fancy, it's like that. So now people ask me, and I think you and I talked about this too, which is, I think it's a great conversation. Like, when do you know to pull them out?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're prideful people, man. We're, you know, I think most of us were probably athletes, and we don't like losing. And when we pull somebody out, we're losing.
Yeah.
But I think as good firemen, we've got to know that point. And if I see I got two lines in there, and I know the guys are working, and it's the smoke is getting worse, it's building up pressure, and it's pushing out, and the vent hole didn't work, or if I've got the fire in the attic running over us in an apartment, man, I have to eat my pride and back them out. And I think that's the safety on them. And then I think, you know, just that's just Mo thinking. We gave the citizens the best possible shot we could at that point. We were in there working. It just beat us today. And I could sleep with myself a little bit better knowing that I pulled them out. And I think if there's any young officers out there, I need to sit down with the chief, I think. And we need to work this out. If a chief ever says back out, there should be no discussion. And, you know, and I did it too as a captain. Hey, give me 5 minutes. We got it. Yeah, just give me 5 minutes. We got it.
Just a couple more minutes.
There needs to be. Yeah, that's right. You know, you've been there. And because you're like, man, I just don't want to get spit out of this thing. And, you know, I'm sitting here laughing, telling you that. But if we have an agreement that I'm going to let you go past where you should have been, when I ask you to come out, just give me some respect and you come out. And we just might have to do a different plan, you know. We put a backup line in place every time. And we have a procedure for our backup line. If we ever have to pull out and regroup, well, that backup line is the last person coming out. And we train on that, on how to do it, how to protect the guys. Well, then what happens is we just don't come out and start taking our stuff off and give up. We might meet at the front door and say, hey, this, or Captain Schroeder, or Captain Novicki, you know, Captain Krejci, or, you know, Mario, somebody will tell me, or Jerry Medina, say, hey, man, if we do this, we can get it. Okay, well, that's our game plan now. But everything we do, man, and you know me and you've been friends for several years. I truly believe we are servants to the community, and that's how we're serving them. If we put them first, but then if we have to go defensive, we're still serving them because we're regrouping to do something different. And then that's kind of how I balance that. Mm-hmm. But I want the guys to be aggressive. And I would, you know, you're a chief, and for guys out there, not chiefs, or if there's any young firefighters out there listening, man, if you're riding first line today, man, you got the best job in the world. But, when you become a captain, you have to watch guys. Then when you become a senior captain, you have to watch a couple more guys. Then when you become chief, you have to watch a couple more guys. And then if we all give each other that same respect, man, we can be aggressive, and man, we can do a good job. But we've just got to all be on the same page that we're going to do our best to not get firemen hurt. You know, it's going to happen. You know, I pray every day. I pray that nothing ever happens to a guy, but it happens. You know, sometimes it's just God's will. And but I think if we all have that mindset and we all train to that mindset, nobody gets their feelings hurt if we have to say, hey, man, back up, let's regroup. And then usually we regroup and we make it better. So that's kind of how I balance it. And if anybody knows me, knows this, if I make a run in the community, and I've always worked in real poor, poor parts of town, and I still do, man, I work for them. Whenever we're through, we talk to kids. We let kids see their fire truck. We go to the adults there, and that's putting them first. That's letting them know they're important to us, because they are. You know, it's that's it. And then as a chief, you give the same respect to your guys and they know they're important. For example, as little of a deal as this is, I don't eat before the guys.
Mm-hmm.
And only reason I do that is I want them to know that they're more important than I am. And that's the same in a long roundabout way. The community is more important than I am. If I get a blister on my back, or, you know, I get hurt, and I've been there. Hey, I chose this. I chose to be a fireman. But man, that little kid trapped in that back bedroom, they didn't choose that. That just happened to them. And man, I just think we got to give that baby the best chance in life for surviving, because they're having the worst day of their life. And we're supposed to be having the best day of our life every response we make. And that's just the kind of balance. And I always keep that in the back of my head. I know it's squirrely. I know a lot of people think, man, you're crazy for thinking like that. But that was the way I was raised in the fire department. You know, it's all about them. And I want little kids to look up to us and like us. And I want the mom and dads know that we're there for them. You know, and I think I said this on an interview one time, and I truly believe it. As weird as it sounded when it came out, when they put their babies to bed at night, we are the watchers. We're there 24/7, 365 days a year, to make sure mom and dads can sleep good at night, put their babies in bed, because they have the best trained firemen coming to help them out if they're having the worst day of their life. And that's just the way I live it. And I would hope somebody would do that to my family, you know. And I know it's probably a big long answer for that, but that's just the way I feel, you know. And I hope I never don't feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I've used you talking about the keepers or the watchers, watching over the community. I talk to people about that from time to time when I give talks or presentations too, and the fact that this job, there's two things about this job, you know. One is that a mother will hand you her newborn baby.
Yes, sir.
When she, you know, she's going to protect that baby like a yep. lion with her cubs. And the other thing is, the same people that don't have a dime to their name, or maybe they do, they'll hand you the keys to their house and say, can you make sure that, you know, you lock up my yep. house, or,
yes, sir.
You know, they'll That's give you it. their wallet or their purse or whatever. And they have enough trust in us, not only with their lives, but with their property. And they know that when the fire department yep. shows up, you know, everything's going to be okay.
Yeah. I got cold chills on my arm, you saying that, because you know what? People know we're the good guys.
Yeah.
Man, we're the man, let's never let them know that we're not the good guys. And you hit the nail on the head. Man, it's not normal for a mama to give up their baby. But you let a fireman come through that door, they know you're gonna fix her problem. And man, you saying that, I got cold chills, because you know, and you're 1,000 miles away. And not because we're friends, and not because we know each other. We got the same mindset, and I bet you there's 10,000 firemen across this country has that same mindset that what you just said.
Well, I sure hope so. I hope there's I hope there's a lot more that think like us than any other way. So,
yes, sir.
We talked a little bit about the fire ground and going on fire runs. I don't know that you and I have ever specifically talked about this, but I wanted to kind of get your take on. How do you balance the way we used to do business, you know, hard charging and just going in low and taking the heat and you know, for the most part, we still do a lot of that today, but now we've got all this modern fire science stuff, and certainly the way our fires burn, you know, fire's still fire, but the stuff that's burning is a lot different. What's your opinion on some of that stuff, and how do you take some of that newer information that's coming out from UL and NIST and all the studies and use it to better the department rather than slow it down?
Yeah, I do study a lot still. Every day I give the fire department some stuff. So I do read stuff. Now, when I was at 46s, it's everything was old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would burn for 2 days and not fall on you. So mm-hmm. now I'm in an area with a lot of apartments, a lot of, you know, things built in the 80s that's burning a lot. So I had to change my tactics a little bit. And I think we got to go back to putting a whole lot of water on it And, you know, things do burn hotter and faster now. And I think we always have to have a plan of getting ahead of it. Now, man, this is controversial, but I'll say it anyway. I'm not a big resetter. I just never did buy into the fact of resetting. And this is why. The steam's got to go somewhere. And every one of us that's been in the fire service for a long time, you can see we got white marks, burn marks on our face. We've been burned. That steam goes somewhere. And I think the hotter that it's burning, and then if you look at the studies on steam, the hotter the steam is, the faster it moves. And if it doesn't have anywhere to go, it actually goes down where the victims are. And then I use this example, and I talk a lot of times about the difference between a dry lung injury and a wet lung injury. If you think about cooking on a stove and you got a 350 degrees, you can stick your hands in there and pull it out. Well, if you're boiling eggs, you cannot put your face over that mm-hmm. because it's the moist heat, right? So that was the problem I have with that. And now some of the studies, you know, I think I'm seeing of the regrowth and that you're maybe not doing anything, push it back and it's coming back. So that's kind of going back to like the fire department that me and you grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we have to be smart enough to know that everything's burning hotter. Everything's felling quicker because it's not normal. Mine in your era, we had nails and wood. Now they got gusset plates and glue. So we have to know that, and we have to approach different angles. Maybe, for example, I'm still going to be aggressive on an apartment. And Rob Fisher, my buddy from the Northwest, it's about 3 o'clock in the morning one morning. We were talking in Florida. And if anybody doesn't know him, I'm telling you, man, you're missing out because that guy is a genius. So he asked me, he goes, Mo, do you cut truss roofs? I said, yeah, we cut them all the time. He goes, yeah, me too. And so then we start talking. But instead of us getting directly over the fire to cut, we've got to get reasonably safe and trained to cut it. And mm-hmm. so his ideal, my ideal is that. So we had to change our tactics a little bit like that. And then the fire department that me and you grew up in, where we just went through the front door, you know, fighting fire like wild Comanche Indians, you know, you just went in and went every way to live out. Well, now we have to back up and we may have to find an alternate way in, because if it's already got in the attic and it's making the trusses weak, we got to come up with a plan B, and we've got to start doing that. So I think young firemen really needs to study how things burn now. Also, you know, and I'm as guilty as anybody. We didn't wear air packs a lot when I was young. We had them, but we just didn't plug in. Now, man, with this stuff, we've got to really be conscious about pulling in, plugging in, because there's no telling what's burning in this furniture. And it's so much hotter now than it was when we were in. So, yeah, we've had to change our tactics, but those tactics doesn't mean that we give up. The tactics just means we get smarter and we have to change with it too. You know, it's just like playing football or baseball. If you're losing, you got to come up with a plan B. Well, I think our plan B is actually, you know, figuring out different ways. And if I could brag on the new generation firefighters compared to ours,
mm-hmm.
man, these guys are so much better at so many things than we ever were. Like, you know, I'm seeing forcible entry techniques that just blows my mind. And so these guys are getting in places that, you know, I could have never gotten in. So then that lets us be a little bit safer. You know, we might go to the next door apartment and we might enter that apartment, and then we may go in and we may take a sheetrock and a stud out and we may make that our attack instead of going through the front door where the roof's sagging. So, yeah, it's the fire service has changed. Mm-hmm. And if we don't change with it, I think we're doing our guys a disservice. So we still got to be aggressive. We still got to be smart, but we've got to, I think we've got to come up with different plans to keep us that way, but also try to keep us safe at the same time. And it's changing every day. I mean, it's, you know, they're probably doing some studies today on some things that we never thought about, you know? So, yeah, I think young guys need to study stuff. Mm-hmm. And, man, get in the books, you know, ask people, call people, I think me and you are two good examples, and I could probably name you 50 people you can send these guys an email or you can call these guys, you're going to get a response, you know, and just like what we do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a buddy of yours too, Jeff Eckert up in Philly.
Yeah.
You know, I see a fire up there that we'll never make, man. I'll call him. Hey, man, what's your tactic on this? Or, you know, I see something. And like yesterday was a perfect example. We were talking about ventilating high rises and we were having some questions or something. So, man, we called Champo. He said, hey, mm-hmm. Champ, what do you got here? And next thing you know, he walks us through it and says, okay, man, it made everybody better. And so that's one good thing I think that young guys have now. And, a lot of good information coming out, you know. If you want to know about flow and water, man, you got to look at Ray McCormick, man. That guy gets it, and that guy's on a totally different level. Kyle Romagus, man, those guys are on a totally different level of flow and water than we ever were. So we got to change like that, and then I think that makes us better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the internet's is a blessing and a curse for the fire service.
I think.
It's great to have access to all that information, but I know, especially with some of the younger folks, and you know, I've been guilty of it myself from time to time. We get going down a squirrel hole or a rabbit hole on that internet, and the next thing you know, you're not talking to your guys or you know the crew,
yes,
and everybody seems to be in their phones and their computers these days. So,
yes, sir, you're exactly right.
I think another takeaway, you know, in this. Me kind of giving a little bit of my personal philosophy, the information and the studies and the science is very informative. It's very important. You know, I don't discount it. I think the thing that we have to realize as a fire service is we can't have one size fits all, one, you know, way of doing things from coast to coast,
yes.
Because a little, you know, a department that doesn't have but a handful of people at a fire, you know, 4, 5, 6 people, whatever they got on duty, is going to have to do things much different than a department that puts 30 people at a fire in less than 5 minutes. You know, there has to be a balance. 100%. There has to be a balance, and people have to realize that just because somebody says that this is the way we got to do our job from now on, you know, it's got to be a guideline. It can't be a mandatory thing. That we
yes,
have
sir.
To do everything the same way. So
I agree. It's you've got, you know, and this is one, I think one good thing about our profession, uh-huh. Man, they throw us a curveball. We got to be able to hit it. And yeah. So it's, we don't do bread and butter every day. And I think by, you know, talking to people, getting out there, you know, asking questions, becoming friends, networking, that's just how we all get better. Cause none of us has ever seen everything. Yeah, you're exactly right. And if I can say something about the internet,
mm-hmm.
we got to stop eating our own. You know, I can't take my values and get on the internet and just destroy some young kid or some person. I've actually got to use it as a good thing and make things better. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And that's networking is the key to that, because you said it. It's not one, right? We make a lot of things, you know. So yeah, and we're lucky to have the internet, I think.
Yeah. No. Yeah. We're definitely better off for it, but sometimes it can.
Oh yeah. Yes, sir.
Jump up and bite us, you know. So
it does. It does. It yeah. Sure does.
Yeah. So we're kind of coming up. We've been going at this for about 45, 50 minutes now. So Mo, can you tell us a little bit, you know, where you see the fire service going, you know, whether it's in Houston or in general? I know you do a lot of traveling. You meet a lot of people around the country. Where do you see the fire service going in the next 5, 10 years or so?
Yes, sir. I think we're winning. We hit a little dead spot there for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And every place I go, I am so encouraged that we're taking this fire service back. We're moving back to the way it was when you and I got in. Mm-hmm. We're going back. We got these young guys, man, they're hard hitters. They're wanting to learn. Man, they're showing up at these conferences, and we're talking to them afterwards. And man, I just get so impressed. We're going in the right direction. I'd say it's a big win, in my opinion. And I'm kind of a positive guy anyway on everything, but we did hit a dead spot there for a while. But it's coming back, and it's coming back with vengeance, man. I got to talk to a recruit class at going to Texas conference, the instructors, man, and I just wanted to hug those instructors. They told these kids, "Hey, man, I know you're out of class, but go out there and listen to these guys." And so a friend of mine said, "Mo, would you mind just talking to them for a minute?" So these guys never even been in the fire station yet, and those kids gave me so much motivation, because you had about 25 or 30 kids, and you could look back and tell the way I was when I was in the academy. And man, that just reinvigorated me, you know. And I think we're winning, you know. I don't know if anybody on here knows, but I'm a big fan of a lot of the guys out there training. Cody Tresserell and Brothers in Battle, man, those guys are out there every day, and they are putting the word out that if you don't get it from them, I don't think you're ever going to get it. But it's about the people we serve. And Cody and those guys, they get it. They get it. And they're putting people first. And young guys are attending their classes by the thousands. And we're reaching them. And I think these young guys are taking and they're running with it. And yeah, it's I see us winning. I don't see us being static anymore. I see us coming back with vengeance to be good.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's been great to see a lot of these conferences come up and different opportunities to get together and network and learn from each other.
Yeah. Well, just like that class you and I taught a couple of years ago. Look how it's grown. I mean, we had a ton of people there, and you know, Arkansas was just going crazy on their training. And the state of North Carolina gets it, man. They pay for their they the state pays for their guys to go get training. And you know, like that weekend we spent together, other than almost burning the building down, yeah, that's a totally different story. But we had a great weekend, and unfortunately, I've been back a couple times after that, and it gets bigger and better every time. And you know, McCormick, man, he's doing something there, you know. And
he is.
Speaking of that, if I could throw Jim's name out there, man, that guy, you need to go to his fire department training network. If you want to go and make fires from somebody who gets it, that's another one. And he's reaching thousands of people. And I get people call me all the time, "Hey, Mo, man, I'm going to FDTN. What do you think?" I said, "That's the best career decision you ever made." And like that, I think we're winning. And I think that I think the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to see the fire service just bloom into greatness. And that's my opinion. I think it's going right.
I would agree. I definitely agree. So, are you traveling? You got any conferences coming up you're talking at or teaching at?
I do, man. I'm like, man, And you know me, man, I'm the luckiest guy in the world, man. God's always been good to me, man. He's thrown something in my hand, you know. I'm going to Mobile next week for a conference. I'm getting to teach with a FDNY a squad guy. After that, I get to go to into the job, and man, I am stoked on that one. That's one I'm pretty fired up about. And then after that, back to Arkansas. So I'm actually. Man, I feel blessed when I say this. I'm not complaining at all. I am blessed that I am booked and already getting booked for 2023. And man, I just yeah, I don't know, man. I'm just tickled, man. I love it, man. I like talking to firemen, hanging out with firemen, and telling fire stories. So man, luckiest guy in the world you're talking to today.
Yeah. Are you coming to FDIC next year?
I put in for it, man. I hope I get selected. You know, that's a dream for everybody. But if not, I will go attend. Steve Sangliducci and myself went last year, and I'd never had such a good time in my entire life that you just see. I mean, you just see these legends walking down the hallway, and you know, they stop and talk to you. I got to talk to Kevin Shea. You know, who would have thought a kid that was born and raised in the country, just became a Houston fireman, would get to stand and talk to Kevin Shea, like, you know, like we've known each other forever. So,
yeah,
man, I hope I get to, brother. It's a blast.
Yeah. Well, I might know a guy that could help you out with that. So,
all right, man, pull me some strings, brother.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do. All right, well, Mo, it's been a pleasure, man. I appreciate you sticking with me on this thing and calling me early in the morning since we didn't get it done last night. But man, I hope I get to see you in person one of these days. I keep trying to get back down there to Arkansas, but it seems like every time Ryan schedules that conference, I've got a conflict that interferes with it. So I'm hoping to get back there myself and get to see guys like you and Ryan and everybody. So,
yes, sir. Man, thank you so much. You know, and just a side note, man, and I would tell you this on the side, man, I really cherish mine and your friendship. It's an honor to get to, you know, be friends with like-minded people. You know, people may not know this, but we talk on the side. Uh-huh. And I cherish that. And man, I really appreciate you letting, you know, just this country kid, man, get to talk about something he loves, you know?
Yeah, it is. I appreciate it too. And I echo those sentiments. It's always nice to have people that think like you and you know, have the same, you know, appreciate the same things and have the same mindset. So I appreciate you coming on the show and, you know, look forward to seeing you here in the future. And for the rest of the audience out there tonight, thanks for tuning in to the Hooks and Hoses podcast. I'm Eric Dryman, your host, and we'll see you hopefully at FDIC, if not sooner. Take care.